As we read through the history of ancient Israel in the scriptures, we find that on repeated occasions, something rather interesting happens with them. And that is, usually just before a significant event in their lives, they take a moment to remember, to reflect, to think back on what it is that God has done for them. We see this after they had escaped Egypt and crossed the Red Sea. We see this as they prepared to enter the Promised Land for the first time, and then 40 years later when they come back for that second time to get into the Promised Land finally. We see it on other occasions throughout their lives that when they stop, they think back and say, let's remember what Yahweh, the God of Israel, has done for us. And our first reading this morning reflects that kind of remembrance. We see this coming from the book of the prophet Isaiah. The Israelites have returned back from exile, this time where they were torn away from the promised land. And now on their return, they are expected to remember the acts of God. We heard these words, I will recount the gracious deeds of the Lord, the praiseworthy acts of the Lord, because of all that Yahweh has done for us according to his mercy, according to the abundance of his steadfast love. Now, of course, these words are being written of God even after Israel experienced the exile, which was understood to be at the hand of God. Yeah, we know that Israel had broken the covenant with God, and so this was a consequence that was coming. But even after experiencing difficulty that they understood to be because of God, they nevertheless responded in gracious thanksgiving for what God has done. How, in keeping with God's character, God was taking care of the people of God. And we find this theme continues on into the New Testament as well. This idea of remembering becoming actually very important, especially around what it is that Jesus did for us on the cross and in his resurrection. In fact, in a few minutes, we are going to be remembering his death, proclaiming his resurrection, and awaiting his coming in glory. We are going to be doing that very act of remembrance, thinking about what it is that God has done. And over again, this is the response that we are to have, recalling the character of God exhibited in God's actions towards us and celebrating what it is that we've seen God do. Well, here we are at the end of 2019. And so this thought encourages us to do exactly this kind of reflection and remembrance over the course of this past year. One of the ways that we can do that is by thinking about what we had done a year ago at the beginning, where we gave opportunity for us to think specifically about something that we would petition God for over the course of the year, something measurable, something that we could actually get our teeth into and make a matter of prayer over the course of the year. Those of you that chose to participate in this activity filled out a green form that came in two parts. One part where you wrote down that measurable request and you hung on to it. The other one you wrote down and gave it to me so that I can pray for you over the course of the year looking for these things and trusting that God might do something about them. Well, there were 24 green forms submitted, and I can tell you that half of them have been answered. Some of these, I might say, have been addressed in a way different than the person was expecting, but we've been able to see that 12 of these 24 requests have been addressed by God over the course of this past year. Of course, that raises the question, what about the other 12? If God has cared so much about these 12 requests, how come it seems that God didn't care so much about those requests? Well, to be honest, some of the 12 that weren't answered, I don't actually know if they've been answered or not, because Kathy makes these available to her art students as well. And so some of these are people that I don't know how to get in touch with, so I have no idea. Maybe something's happened, I don't know. But for those that still haven't been answered or things that are still in progress, I cannot take a position of saying, oh, well, who cares? How come it can't be all or nothing? If God is going to be a God who actually has steadfast love, then shouldn't he care about all of them equally? Well, there's a couple of good questions that come up by asking that one. A couple of implications about this sense of what do we do with this notion of a God who might respond to prayer? One of the questions is, what do you do when you don't see all the requests answered? What do you do when you read about, like we did in the gospel, all these babies that got killed because Herod decided to be evil? What do we do with these scenarios that don't seem to mesh with this sense of a God who answers prayer? Well, let's break that down a little bit and start with the concept of even believing that there's a God who listens to our prayers and actually answers them. After all, that is what we see reflected over and over again throughout the scriptures, throughout the practice of the church. We are told to bring our concerns to prayer. The end of the book of James talks about that. Is any one of you sick? He should pray. Ask for the elders of the church to come and lay hands on him, anoint him with oil, and the prayer offered in faith will make the sick person well. The Lord shall raise him up. There is this encouragement over and over again that we have a God who responds to prayer. We talk about intercessions. That's really what's happening in the prayers of the people. When we are led in those prayers and we respond, Lord, hear our prayer, we are praying not just for our own benefit, but saying to God, would you do something about these things? Would you bless our leaders? Would you guide those of us who are taking upon certain responsibilities? Would you meet the needs of the people we write down on our list who have different concerns? We are anticipating that God would actually do something about that. So the moment we act in that way and become people of prayer, we are bringing ourselves to that place of acknowledging that God actually cares and actually acts or might act. Because it's obvious that not all of our prayer requests get addressed. We have to leave that piece to one side, but still understand that we are to come to God in prayer. Why? Because God has promised to respond. God has promised to be present. God has reflected God's character to be one of care and concern and steadfast love. Now, someone who has a concern about that might say, well, wait a minute, though. Let's just think this through. Is it not possible that these 24 requests that were submitted at the beginning of the year and that we prayed for and stuff, is it not possible that the 12 that were answered just, well, they would have happened anyway? Is it not possible that it could simply be something coincidental, that the things that we were actually naming in prayer happened to be resolved? Could it not be that that's the scenario? Well, it's certainly something to think about. Is it possible that could be the case? I guess. But someone had an answer for that a number of years ago. I forget who it was that said this. And their statement was, you know, a funny thing. The more that I pray, the more coincidences I experience. And that's a cute answer for sure. It is certainly not one that answers all of the questions about that. But it does acknowledge something. Why, if it's possible that some things may be coincidental, does that have to mean then that all of them are nothing but coincidental? Can there not be room for the thought that indeed God did indeed answer some of those requests? Sometimes people have issues with that because we cannot fathom how God could do that. How God could be paying attention to 7 billion people in the world and actually listening for their prayers and being ready to act. We have difficulty imagining that such a thing could happen. There are different movies that have come out that tried to illustrate some of these challenges. One of them is the Jim Carrey movie, Bruce Almighty. If I remember correctly, Morgan Freeman, who is playing God, granted this guy, Bruce, the opportunity to have almighty power for a while. And so Bruce got to be God for a while. And in all of the fun things that he was doing with his newfound powers, one of the things he found daunting was how quickly his email box filled up with prayer requests. And the implication was there's no possible way he could keep track of all of this multitude of requests. That notion alone makes it difficult for people to believe that God could be one that would receive our prayers, that would hear our prayers, and would even answer our prayers. But the problem with that perspective is it is taking God to be nothing more than just a superhuman. A human being with the same limitations we do, the same ability or inability, as it were, to process a million emails at once. And what we need to remember is that we're dealing with one who exists on a plane beyond ours, one who is not a reflection of us. Instead, we are the ones created in the image of God, not the other way around. And in order to kind of grasp this significant observation, I want to draw from a book that was written 150 years ago by a guy named Edwin A. Abbott. The book is called Flatland. And it was usually categorized as science fiction, but it would be better to categorize it as mathematics and religion at the same time. And how the story of Flatland basically goes, the synopsis of this is we are following the main character who is a square, because all the people in Flatland are various shapes. There are triangles and squares and circles and hexagons and so on. And they live in this two-dimensional existence. They only know length and width. That's it. There's no concept of height. And so we get to learn about their lives and how they relate to one another and how they recognize each other. Because looking at a shape from the edge, all you would see is a line, right? But then they talked about how they could detect that it was a triangle or a circle or what have you by looking at how the line fades on the sides and stuff like that. Really interesting thought experience on what it would be like to live in a two-dimensional world. But then a sphere enters into Flatland. And the square engages with this sphere and has his mind blown about this notion of a third dimension. So to springboard from that foundational thought from that book from 150 years ago, let me posit this to you. Imagine that we live in a two-dimensional universe. That's all we know. Length and width, we're flat. We bump into each other, we talk to each other, we can see each other. That's how life is. This is what we know. That's the world. Then let's say a three-dimensional being comes in, and there's two of us talking together. A three-dimensional being decides to pick up one of the people and picks him up like this. What does it look like to the person who's left standing there? He disappeared. Holy smokes, where'd he go, right? And then if that three-dimensional person puts him over here, our response is, he disappeared and rematerialized over there, or he teleported, or he translated or something. This is crazy. This is a miracle. How did you do that? And of course, the three-dimensional person is going, all I did is I picked him up and I put him over here. Like, it's not a big deal. But to someone who is incapable of conceiving of that third dimension, it is nothing short of miraculous. It is nothing short of supernatural. And yet the third-dimension person is saying, no, it's easy. It's not hard. You just bring the person up. Of course, it'd be fascinating to know what the person who got lifted up was thinking. How would they describe the experience they had just had? Well, I was standing talking to this person, and then all of a sudden I could see above him. I think. Is that the word you'd use? I don't know. How do you put it into words? It would be beyond ability to describe. There'd be no language for it. Because it's a dimension that is not conceived of. Let's take this one step further. Let's say that three-dimensional being, God, decided to impose God's self into that plane of existence. Let's say God took, you know, let's use the word there, right? God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Let's say God took their hand and put their fingers into the plane of our existence. What would that look like to us living in a two-dimensional world? Well, we'd see five lines, but we would learn by observing that these would be five circles. We'd see five circles, and we'd see that this is five circles. So how would you describe God? First of all, are you having an experience of God? Yes, you are. How do you describe God? I'd say God was five circles. Would that be correct? Well, based on the limitations of your ability to observe, yes, it would be correct as far as it goes, but is it actually a valid and complete description of God? No, it's incomplete. It's necessarily incomplete because God is three-dimensional and we're only seeing his five fingers put in there. That's it. But there's so much more. And so there is an experience of God, and yet it is inadequate. It is true insofar as we are able to describe in the limits of our two-dimensional existence, but it is not sufficient because God exists in three dimensions. And what God is able to do in three dimensions, we cannot even conceive of in two. Scientists tell us today, those who study string theory, that there are actually 10 or 11 dimensions in which we live. The fourth dimension is time. Then there's a fifth and sixth dimension, a seventh and eighth dimension, a ninth and tenth dimension. They tend to exist in pairs for some reason. Actually, I know some of the reason, but there's no time to go into it. The point, though, is that science is not defeating the notion of God. I would suggest to you it is helping us understand how God could be. These dimensions, scientists insist, are part of our existence, are very difficult to conceive of and almost impossible to actually observe, and yet they would insist that they are there. Some would actually hypothesize that there are more dimensions. Now, is it not possible that just as a third dimension is inconceivable to a two-dimensional being, that our existence in our four dimensions, and then learning that there are up to 10 or 11 dimensions, is it not possible that we would have difficulty in being able to conceive of how those dimensions would work? And anybody that lived fully within and knowledgeably within those dimensions, would they not be able to do something that would seem to be us nothing more than miraculous? What if God just simply resides in the eighth dimension fully? And we just can't conceive of that. I don't know which dimension number it would be, but the point that I'm making is simply this. We are the ones created by the Creator. We are ones who are limited in our understanding. We see that in the Bible itself. The people who wrote this book 2,000 to 3,000 years ago wrote it with an ancient phenomenological understanding of science. That's how come the Psalm talks about the sea monsters praising him. Right? Sea monsters, whatever. You know, we've learned biologically that there aren't sea monsters, they're just pretty fantastic beings that live in the sea. This notion that somehow science has to be opposed to God is a faulty understanding. And part of the reason it comes up is because we've done it to ourselves. I say we as Christians over the course of many years. Because what we have tended to do is if we find a gap in our understanding, we have simply said, well, just insert God there. How is it that the moon stays up there? Well, God just holds it in place. And then when science discovers gravity and how orbits work, we realize, no, God isn't holding the moon there. That's just how it goes. And God gets pushed out of the equation because our scientific understanding has discovered how the moon actually hangs there. We might wonder how on earth that eating nourishes us. Well, God just makes the food go where it needs to go. And then we learn about nutrients and vitamins and enzymes and so on, and God gets pushed out of the equation again because obviously he's not needed. This is the problem with what is called a God of the gaps understanding. If all we do is take our ignorance and just stick God there, then we shouldn't be surprised that when science comes along and discovers and takes away that ignorance, that the implication is that God was always unnecessary, that God is always the imaginary one to fill in the gaps of our ignorance. We ought not to do that. It's because we've done that that we have this issue between God and science that need not be. Instead, as our scientific understanding increases, we begin to learn more about how God does things, or how God fits into the equation, or how a God who actually can pay attention to the prayers of 7 billion people can exist. Because there are dimensions that we cannot grasp or can barely grasp. It feels like we're holding on with our fingertips. And to think that there is someone beyond us, someone who is personal, someone who actually can and does respond. As we move into 2020, I would encourage you not to ever be in a hurry to dispense with the notion of a God who actually answers prayer, of a God who actually cares. I would encourage you to consider taking the example revealed to us in the scriptures and down through 2,000 years of church history to understand that there is a reason for prayer. There is a reason for intercession. Sometimes people say, well, it's been proven. You get a psychological benefit from prayer. Science has proven that there is a psychological benefit. Fair enough. Yes, there is. There is a psychological benefit for those who pray versus those who don't pray. But why does that have to mean then that that's all there is to it? Does it not make sense that a God who cares and who would instruct us to petition God for the things that we need, does it not make sense that that act alone would also be beneficial, let alone what God would do in response? Why does it have to be all or nothing? Let me encourage you to think about that. Over the course of this year, we're going to be talking more about the character of God, about what that steadfast love of God for God's people is like, about who this God is that we petition in prayer, and we will give greater opportunity for prayer. Not just opportunities for prayer from here when the prayers of the people happen and we list the names of the people that we write down because God knows their needs before we even ask, but opportunities for people to receive prayer personally. where I can pray for you directly, or even a few of us together. There's something to be said for that kind of experience of having fellow Christians gather around you and pray specifically for what it is that concerns you, and to find that combined faith in trusting that the Spirit of God will do the work necessary. So as we come into 2020, look for those opportunities. Be willing to take a risk, perhaps, and be one to receive prayer in that way when the opportunity comes. But let me encourage you also to consider, as we did a year ago, of thinking about one thing in particular that you want to trust God for in 2020. There's a new stack of green forms and a slightly darker shade of green on the table out there just outside the nave. I invite you to take one of those with you. And think about that one thing. Rather than worrying about New Year's resolutions about what you're going to do this year, what's the one thing you're going to trust God for in 2020? Make it a matter of prayer throughout the year. I will pray with you as you give me your half of that form. We look forward to seeing what'll happen a year from now. Let's take God up on God's offer and be willing to believe that God indeed is one who cares and listens and responds. Amen.